Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody. See many people here willing to make the effort to come up on a New Year's Eve. Lots of other things to do on New Year's Eve. Yeah, I think it's indicative of the interest and sincerity that you have. There's lots of ways that we can be distracting ourselves, keeping ourselves occupied, keeping ourselves busy. The world is actually quite adept at doing that. So to be able to come to a monastery and to sort of bore yourselves into the new year, it's quite wonderful. I've just returned from Thailand, and I spent the last month in Asia, 2 weeks in Malaysia and 2 weeks in Thailand. I just got back 2 nights ago, still kind of discombobulated and rather, tired. This is a worthy tradition to be maintaining and joining in, to be a part of, bringing in the new year in a special way. It's actually how I began my stay, visit, residence in the United States. I arrived here New Year's Eve of 1996 and entering into 1997. This is it was kind of an anniversary for me as well, in the sense of this is New Year's. I think I arrived something like 10 or 10:30 of New Year's Eve, and they picked me up at the airport and took me to a place that was the meeting place for Sangapala Foundation for many years. And I had a New Year's gathering that night, brought in the New Year's, and beginning my segment of the Abhayagiri adventure. And it's been a great adventure. I've actually liked America. that surprised me. So that this sense of coming together, so it has a certain specialness for me of these New Year's gatherings. And of course it's a tradition. All through our lineage, there'll be monasteries in the West. People will be gathering. I guess we're about the last, actually. The monasteries in New Zealand started, 20 hours ago, and went through to the Australia, the Thai monasteries, Malaysia. Thailand's 15 hours ahead of us, so they're probably even rested up from their new year. So that, and then of course the monasteries in Europe and England, east coast of America and Canada, and now us here in California. I think having the opportunity to bring the new year in a way that establishes a sense of very wholesome reflection, wholesome recollection The sense of recollection is so important in Buddhism, because the kind of you know, it's easy to sort of think, you know, I just really need to be more mindful, more grounded in the present moment, more, you know, peaceful, and which is, you know, good. But I think it's good to remember that the root of what we call mindfulness is in memory, recollection, being able to remember, which of course, you know, a lot of people tomorrow won't be able to remember New Year's Eve very much, or it'll be a bit of a blur. So that sense of recollection, reminding ourselves of what is useful, what's important, what's actually helpful for living a skillful life. And, you know, if you think in terms of the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha's, you know, giving us guidelines and giving us encouragement to lead a life that increases our happiness and well-being and decreases our suffering. That's the actual standard of when everyone asks studies the teachings and what are the indications of a growth and development, progress in the path, in the Buddhist teachings, what are the indications of a lack of growth or hitting an obstacle for not really progressing at all, and it comes down to that, in that sense of, you know, the what is it that increases the wholesome basis of happiness and well-being, and decreases the unwholesome roots of suffering and dis-ease in the mind, in the heart. Those are that one can know that one is actually progressing, developing, to be able to recognize clearly what is it that helps one to increase in those wholesome qualities, the wholesome roots of happiness and well-being, to really see more clearly what are the aspects that will lead to the relinquishing or undermining of the unwholesome roots of dis-ease and suffering. The Buddha points to the Four Noble Truths are a essential foundation for the whole of the Buddhist teachings. Everything is that's the very first teaching that the Buddha gave, and sometimes it's easy to think, well, you know, it's just this sort of rinky-dink teaching that he gave at the beginning of his of early times of his ministry, and he got better as he went along, and there must be more interesting and more fascinating things than that. And of course, the Buddha didn't actually say that, he kept returning over and over again over 45 years of his teaching to that that structure of the Four Noble Truths. And then even when he gave other teachings, he would keep using that template as a basis for the teachings, because what it's doing is giving a how it's structured is actually structuring it in the way that at the time of the Buddha, how a physician, how a doctor would look at illness, at a disease, so that one would look at, okay, what is the actual symptoms? What are the symptoms of that disease, and then what's the so it's like a diagnosis. What are the symptoms? What's the cause of that? What's the cause of that disease? What's the cause of that? And then what's the prognosis? And what's the way to actually actualize or to realize that prognosis? Especially if the prognosis is the end of suffering. That's if one wants to, and then there's a way to actually accomplish that, rather than the Buddha giving a prognosis. Well, the actual symptoms are suffering. The prognosis is just more misery and suffering. It's kind of hopeless. But that isn't what the Buddha taught. There is an ending, a cessation of suffering. There is a opportunity for realizing complete peace. But there's a way to do it that actually facilitates that. And the that aspect of the these Four Noble Truths being grounded in the experience of suffering, of dis-ease, of dissatisfaction, of discontent, just the recognition that there is this tendency in the human condition that we're all, nobody really wants. And then how does that come about? So to be able to take an interest in that. And, the reality is that oftentimes people sort of say, wow, these Theravadins, they're so sort of stick in the mud type of religious doctrine, and everything's about suffering. But if it were, when you take a look at that template as the Buddha taking the same structure as a physician, then if you went to a regular doctor and for a checkup or something, and the doctor asks you, where does it hurt? You wouldn't think that's a strange thing to do. You wouldn't think that's a strange question. You went to the doctor, you go to a doctor and you all he says, oh, it'll be all right, everything will be fine, it's going to be good, just keep on doing whatever you're doing, just you'll be okay. You'll probably get better. I'd have a doubt. So that sense of okay, let's take a look at what the difficulty is. What's the problem? Especially if you think of it in terms of your own health, if we're really concerned about our long-term health and well-being, then we have to pay attention to the things that are problematic to our health. So that sense of looking at dukkha and seeing that that's it's a way to look at the human condition as directly and as directly as possible, and to recognize what are the different experiences of suffering, and suffering having all sorts of nuances, and probably the best way to describe it is the way that etymologically what the roots of the word dukkha actually are, and it's actually a word that comes, it predates the Buddha by a long time, and comes from an early time of the, because the Indian culture, northern Indian culture, is actually from there. They came down from probably the central steppes of Asia, and moved down through like Afghanistan, Pakistan, into the Central Valley, and they were horse people, and they had carts and they had chariots, and that was their main mode of transportation, of working, of trade, and the word for say sukha and dukkha, they're words that mean like when an axle fits into a wheel, when that axle fits into the wheel perfectly, then that's sukha, and when that axle doesn't quite fit and it rubs, or it wobbles, or it bumps along, and there's difficulty, and it's not smooth, that's dukkha. So it's actually a wonderful description of dukkha. It's just sort of what was hopefully a smooth, pleasant experience in your nice new cart, and it just bumps along, or it squeaks, or it just is irritating in some way, shape, or form. And that's what dukkha is. So it's not, some kind of, a personal judgment, or absolute... abject misery, but it's just difficult. It's complicated. And it's uncomfortable. And it's discomfort, dis-ease. So that experience, it's something that we all have, and nobody seeks it out. Nobody sort of is hoping. Nobody begins a new year Everybody says Happy New Year. You know, it's nobody sort of says, oh, miserable New Year. Or if you do it, you don't associate with them. You sort of find your way to, distance yourself real quick from that person. But that reality of dukkha keeps coming up. So that being able to recognize it as an experience, but then also what the Buddha is saying is that with these, like part of the teaching on the Four Noble Truths is also recognizing that we have a certain duty or responsibility to the each of the teachings. It's like that first discourse that the Buddha gives, and the Buddha saying, it wasn't until I saw these Four Noble Truths and their 12 aspects that I could declare that I was a fully enlightened being. And what is that structure is the actual, say, the truth itself, and then there's the duty, responsibility that one has towards it, and then there's having accomplished that, having fulfilled that duty, so that with the first noble truth, that experience of dukkha, the experience of discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, that's the first aspect of the first noble truth. The aspect that is its duty or responsibility that we have towards it is that, dukkha is to be understood. So that willingness to understand it, to know it. The third aspect is that it has been understood. So that sense of having understood it clearly, having known it completely, so that each of the Four Noble Truths has that element of there's the actual truth itself, there's the duty that one has, and then having fulfilled that duty, that responsibility. So that sense of you being willing to understand, to look at, to know clearly the experience of dukkha, and to know it clearly isn't to kind of identify with it, to indulge in it, to judge it as something that is an indication of one's personal success or failure. It's just there is dukkha. It's just that's what it is. It's just it's as natural as anything else. But what happens with that is, of course, we tend to react to it. We get caught up in it. We get entangled in it. We identify with it as me. We resent it. The whole range of reactions that we have to that experience of dukkha, and on a certain level it's quite natural, but that's because it still hasn't been understood. It hasn't been known clearly. And then when we're willing to really look at it, to understand it, to know it, then what happens is, quite naturally, we start to see more clearly, well, where does it come from? What's its cause? What's its root? And of course, the duty or the responsibility to the cause of dukkha is that, say, the cause of suffering is to be abandoned. The cause of suffering is to be relinquished, so that we can be letting go of that cause. But I think it's how do you say, it's helpful to, again, reminding ourselves what our habits are. What's our habits? What's our conditioning? I'm sure for almost all of us is that when we experience some kind of suffering, some kind of difficulty, what we want to do is get rid of it. How can I get rid of it? How can I basically abandon the suffering, relinquish the suffering, and just not have to deal with it? Or at least, you know, not now. So our efforts go into trying to abandon the cause of suffering, relinquish the cause of suffering, at a point in time when we haven't really understood it and known it clearly. So that it's a bit, it's out of sync. It's out of we're doing things out of the order that the Buddha is saying will be efficacious, will actually work. If anything that we can understand from the from all of the teachings that the Buddha gave is that he was immensely practical. He wasn't a demagogue. He wasn't one who was incredibly skilled in philosophical speculation or religious debate. All of those things he thought were pretty much a waste of time. And he focused on what is practical and what's useful. And the what's useful is not suffering. Yeah. And that that's how he understood a spiritual path to be truly beneficial. And we think of these Four Noble Truths, as beliefs, and they're not beliefs, but they're things that we need to contemplate, investigate, take the time and effort to say, well, how does this play itself out? And then, what's it like to what is the cause? So the Buddha's pointing to, when the Buddha points to the cause of suffering, he points to internal qualities. He's not pointing to external manifestations of some sort of difficulty, because it ends up how we deal with it. Because something can be difficult and challenging, or some people can be quite difficult and challenging, but it's us who suffers. It's like Ajahn Chah teaching.
Natural human interactions, there can be quite, it can be hurtful exchanges that happen, or we get slandered and blamed, criticized, or we're judged in some way. And Ajahn Chah gave the example, which is, in Thailand it's quite extreme. In America, it's probably not so. The sting is not there, in the sense that the worst thing you can call somebody in Thailand is a dog, and I don't know. I learned my language, Thai language, in a monastery, so I don't know that many, you know, really bad words. but I do know that if in Thai culture and interactions, if you get called a dog, then that's when weapons start coming out. and if so, Ajahn Chah used that as an example. He said, "Well, you know, if somebody calls you a dog, you know, what do you do?" And it's very shocking to say that in Thai. He said, "If somebody calls you a dog, what do you do?" He said, "You know, most people get incredibly upset and angry." And he said, "But all you need to do is just look behind you and see if you've got a tail. If you don't have a tail, well, then it's not true. Why do you have to believe it? Why do you have to get caught in it? Why do you have to make a problem out of it? It's not even true." So that sense of even something that normally would create a tremendous amount of suffering, when we look at it from another perspective, we realize, "Oh, I'm creating my own suffering by getting angry at this, getting upset at this, getting worried at that, getting fearful of that, or all the different kinds of wanting that we have, that we posit our well-being and happiness on getting what we want." Those are all kind of they're kind of shaky bases for one's happiness and well-being. And of course, that's the classic description of dukkha that the Buddha gives. He goes through the different manifestations of it: sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I mean, these are all dukkha, how we feel things. And then separation from the loved is dukkha, association with the disliked or unwanted is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. And then he sort of, in short, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. When the mind focuses on, and those are the sort of mind, feeling, perception, memory, thoughts and emotions, consciousness, just the things that we identify as me. So that those are, especially when it comes from grasping, those are all dukkha. So that seeing that more clearly, and that sense of recognizing these, what are those causes, and the Buddha points to different forms of desire, and the word is tanha, which is, when it's translated, it's translated as desire most frequently. But it's important to know that tanha is a very specific word that is saying, and that's the kind of desire that's associated with greed, hatred, and delusion, that always ends up in suffering. There's actually other kinds of desire that the Buddha encourages. Like the Buddha says, it's helpful to desire wholesome virtue. It's very beneficial to desire peace And it's very beneficial to desire truth. I mean, those are very important motivations for living a skillful life. We can make suffering out of it, but that fundamental kind of desire as a wholesome motivation is the basis of progress on the path. So that to be able to encourage ourselves in supporting that those kinds of, when we have a skillful motivation or a real motivation for well-being and harmony and inner peace and wholesome qualities, that isn't to just sort of, oh, I can't desire that. I'm supposed to be free from all desire. Because you end up blocking yourself off for cultivation and development. And it's really one has to nourish those wholesome roots of skillful desire or motivation, interest. Those are maybe other ways of expressing it. Oftentimes they're translated exactly the same, and they're different words. One is tanha, which I said is always going to end up in suffering, always associated with greed, hate, and delusion. But the other word is chanda, and that's a wholesome, skillful desire. And we have to learn how to see what's the difference between the two. And again, it comes back, how do I know what's tanha, desire that's going to lead to suffering, and chanda that's going to lead to growth and development. And that's where coming back to that sense of, well, what's the result? Because the Buddha is very practical. So, okay, what's the result? And because quite naturally, those wholesome desire, wholesome motivation nourishes, say, wholesome roots of virtuous qualities, and they result in well-being and happiness. That's a natural quality. The technical term that's used in Buddhism is kusala and akusala, and and oftentimes one sees it translated as wholesome, as skillful, those are the actions of body, speech, and mind, and then they lead to well-being, they lead to peace, they lead to an increase of these wholesome qualities. And the akusala is sort of unwholesome, unskillful. And that's what leads to suffering, distress, dis-ease. There's always a quality of certain restlessness, agitation there, quality of the sense of self, and a feeling of separation is there, because we hold to a position of I, and that's where, when we look at the Four Noble Truths, we look at things from the point of Four Noble Truths, then we have an opportunity to step out of that habit of viewing experience from a position of I and other, and we're just looking at phenomena, cause and effect relationships, or say like being and non-being. We get into these dichotomies or these kind of dualistic types of mental positions or emotional positions, and it's always setting us up for discontent. So the Buddha's, they say, the use of these Four Noble Truths allows us to drop that sense of I and myself and other being impinging on me, or having to compare oneself to others outside, whether it's comparing in terms of superior, equal, inferior. Those are all positions that are suffering. And that it's incredible relief to not have to buy into that position. It's hard to even imagine what it would be like. We're so used to that whole, defining ourselves externally by the how we compare or line up to others, what we feel the world is either giving or taking away from us, and so that just being able to be present with experience and to understand it, to not be confused by it, to not be dragged around by it, to not to feel overwhelmed by it. And well, there's this experience. It's to be understood. The cause of whatever difficulty can be abandoned. But then it's important to recognize that the Buddha's teaching, say, is not just about that sense of suffering, constantly trying to figure out, what the cause of that suffering is and how to abandon it. Obviously one needs to do that, but it's also important to recognize that there is a cessation of suffering, there is an end of suffering, there is an experience, to cast that in a positive vocabulary, that sense of, there is peace, there is contentment, there is happiness. And, of course, there's a cause for that to arise. And it's really important to, that recognizing that what the Buddha is pointing to as a way of assessing one's situation is to look carefully at suffering. But then also when he's giving you the tools for freeing the heart from suffering, or giving the tools for the experience of the cessation of suffering, every single part of that is conducive to happiness. So, like that Eightfold Noble Path, Noble Eightfold Path, or the kind of training that the Buddha gives as a under three kind of basic headings. Which is how the Eightfold Path is also these are the three kind of sikha or trainings to be done, a practitioner of the path. So that training, studying, practicing with virtue, so that one's establishing oneself in right speech, right action, right livelihood. And so that sense of what's the result when I speak in a way that is truthful, is sensitive to the situation that I'm in, when I speak in a way that is not say not gossiping, having kindly speech. And the Buddhas are saying, yeah, when we use speech in skillful ways, what it brings about is an external harmony, a bonds of friendship and bonds of trust with other human beings, and that's an incredible gift to oneself, and of course a gift to others. When we lays the roots of happiness for us, because when we're able to live with trust and friendship and a sense of kind of a respect for ourselves and for others, then there's a real well-being that is laid down as a basis for our existence. So that, and then the aspects of say of mental training, aspect of say of right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, those are again basis of happiness. When we're able to put forth effort in a skillful way, employ our energies in a way that and right effort is always defined by the increase of wholesome dhammas, wholesome mental states, wholesome qualities, and the decrease of the unwholesome, and that's it's a bit more stylized or formulated, but in the sense of being able to prevent unwholesome mental states from arising, and to be able to relinquish unwholesome mental states that have arisen, and then to be able to bring into being, to develop wholesome mental states that haven't arisen, and then to maintain and to sustain wholesome mental states that have arisen, how to make them firm, how to make them solid. So that is conducive to very naturally to happiness and well-being. It just is the natural result. The mindfulness, when we're able to live mindfully with alertness and clear comprehension in our daily lives, there's a tremendous well-being that is there. We understand more clearly what our own intentions are, what our own feelings are. It's not confused by the world around us. Right concentration, meditation. When meditation is going well, when it's really establishing oneself in states of meditative stability, there's tremendous happiness. There's a discourse where it sounds sort of like the Buddha's kind of bragging a bit, but it's kind of a debate that somebody was foisted on him, and of course, debate around spiritual life and worldly life, and basically that worldly life of you got a lot more opportunity for happiness and well-being than than these monks living in these monasteries doing nothing. And then the Buddha sort of saying, well, you know, who do you think has more happiness, me or King Bimbisara, who was the head of the largest kingdom in India at the time, and actually a good righteous ruler. And then the person says, well, you know, so using his logic, you know, of course King Bimbisara has got to be a lot happier than you are. You know, you're just sort of hanging out on your own in the monastery, which actually doesn't happen. The Buddha was always surrounded by people and doing all sorts of things. But then the Buddha is sort of saying, well, you know, do you think King Bimbisara can maintain a state of unrelenting happiness and bliss for you know, one full day? And he said, I don't think he could. And then the Buddha sort of says, well, I can. And he says, not only can I maintain a state of unrelenting happiness and bliss for one day, I can do it for a day, a full day, a full night. I can do it for 2 days, 2 nights. I can do it for 7 days and 7 nights. Just unrelenting happiness and bliss. And those are states of meditative absorption, meditative attainment. When the mind is not, when it's only engaging with its meditation object, that is a possibility. So that's extreme example, but it's good to know that such things exist. And certainly the happiness of mindfulness when the Buddha encourages us to develop meditation, and to bring the mind to a place of stability, always the description is of your first experience of meditative stability. Is accompanied by joy or rapture and happiness and bliss. And also that in developing that, he gives the image of taking a ball of powder and then putting a bit of water. It's in those days, it's like a bath powder that you would use to you would knead it. And maybe a better image would be that we're more familiar with is maybe even say like a dough, say a bread or something, where one takes flour and then mixes it with water so that it gets completely mixed with the dough, and then the water doesn't drip out, and the flour doesn't sort of puff away, so that it can get that flour and that dough become completely mixed, and what is left is a ball of a consistent, sort of dough. It's not runny. It's not dry. It's at the absolute right consistency. And that's how the Buddha describes what we need to do with those experiences of rapture and bliss, and our thought processes, directed thought, evaluation, and a sense of unification, all of those are mixed together. They're mixed together so that he said in the same way that there's no part of that dough that isn't sort of pervaded and suffused and filled with that water. We do the same thing with those qualities of well-being, of happiness, of bliss, of directing our thoughts, evaluating, that it's unified, it comes together. We do that with our body, so that there's no place in our body that isn't filled and suffused with that happiness and bliss. And it's a very important image, because there's so much gritting one's teeth and meditating, enduring or forcing or pushing, trying really hard to get something, attain something out of the meditation. And we forget to bring it in, internalize it. These are experiences of well-being. They're experiences of stability and calm, so that to really learn how to bring that in. And that's one of the qualities of when we do the chanting is opanayiko. It's the Dhamma of the Buddhas is leading inwards. And it's not sort of being directed outside somewhere. It's being drawn inwards, so that give oneself that opportunity to experience that well-being. And that's part of the path. It's because sometimes I think there's a certain amount a certain suspicion of if you start to feel too good meditating and practicing, you start to worry that you're something's wrong. Is it legal? is it okay? Is it okay? Can I do this? Can I actually feel good and, practice the Buddha's path? And it's exactly what it's for. When you see this sila, virtue, samadhi, meditation, and wisdom, those aspects of right view and right thought. Those are all concerned with bringing about happiness and well-being. It's really interesting that, say, like in there's a list of all of 10 things that are meritorious action, punya, and in Thai it's called boon. So that usually, oftentimes, when thinking that, say, like to say to make merit means only to make material offerings, but the Buddha gave there's a whole list of 10 things that are considered punya, and that are boon, and when the Buddha talks about punya, he says very explicitly, do not be afraid of punya. Punya is another word for happiness. And so that it lines up in terms of the different actions that lead to punya. And of course, the first being generosity and giving, sila, virtue, and moral integrity, bhavana, mental development, mental cultivation, the aspects of respect and deference, being a an avenue of punya, of service, being another avenue of punya, a dedication of merit, a dedication of, say, when having done something that is meritorious or is generous or is skillful, and then to bring to mind, yeah, may others benefit from this wholesome action, you know, to actually share the blessings of that, and then to one's animal, and to delight in the goodness of others, delight in the skillful action of others. This is avenues of punya. And then, hearing the Dhamma, studying the Dhamma. You know, in the Buddha's time, then hearing the Dhamma was really limited to getting close to somebody who's teaching and really listening to it with your ears. I mean, now there's books. There's Dhamma talks, a gazillion Dhamma talks in MP3 format. You can see it on YouTube and Vimeo. There's any number of means of accessing the Dhamma. So that to study it, to learn it, to hear it in some way, shape, or form, it's punya. One is learning about the teachings of the Buddha, and then to give Dhamma. In terms of sometimes you're like, because sometimes you say, oh, I've got to be a sort of Dhamma teacher and sit up in the front and be able to teach before I can give any Dhamma. But any kind of encouragement that one is giving to others, or encouraging them to establish themselves in truth and these skillful teachings of the Buddha, that's a giving of Dhamma. And even so, seeing somebody who's suffering and having one of the publications to give to somebody, it's a giving of Dhamma. And that intention is, can be quite pure. Of course, the more pure the intention, of course, the more meritorious or more punya it actually is. But the point I'm actually getting to is that the last avenue of the and the highest form of creation of punya is straightening out one's views, so that if one's view is that practicing the Dhamma of the Buddha is sort of miserable and imbued with interminable suffering, then that has a certain result. And then if one's view is one of, oh, these teachings are really useful for understanding the human condition and to really take on the responsibility of living skillfully in the human condition. So that has a very different outcome. So that's straightening out one's views. And so, of course, those Four Noble Truths and they say those responsibility or the duty to the Four Noble Truths, that's really lining oneself up with what is it that's actually going to lead to increased happiness and well-being, what's going to lead to a decrease of suffering. So that, wow, okay. I just looked at the clock. Okay, I've been going on for too long. I don't want to increase your suffering and discomfort. So really as a New Year's wish to everybody, and to really take the teachings of the Buddha to heart, bring them into the heart, and to really see, okay, how can I fulfill those that wish of the Buddhas for us to understand, yeah, what is our responsibility and duty as a intelligent, responsible human being, somebody in the human condition? How can we free ourselves from suffering? So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Sam.